Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Hacking, fake news, and paid trolls, both from within the country and from afar. Are they destroying democracy? We are joined by Jennifer Forstall, who's a professor of political science at Stockton University, and by Chris Tenove. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at the Center for Ethics and the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you here with us. You both look at a type of threat to democratic processes: hacking, trolling, fake news, sort of corrupted information. So maybe the place to start in a conversation like this is, why are these threats to democracy? What is it that we need in democracy in terms of information, in terms of deliberation, for it to function properly and to maintain it? Chris Tenove, do you want to start?
I'd love to. And that's a great question and exactly the one I've been thinking about. We're learning so much about what happened in terms of what bots were promoting, what messages, what kinds of fake news stories were circulated, but we still don't really know their effects. And I think we don't know how to talk about what they're doing to our democracy. So the former CIA acting director, Michael Moore, described these kinds of digital interference as, it's an attack on our democracy, it's an attack on who we are as a people. And I do think we need to think about all the ways in which that might be true. So the way that I am thinking about this is to use one, this is an analogy, but thinking about democracy as people coming to a table. They get a spot at that table in order to vote. That's one way they contribute, but also to advance their views in public discussions, protest, join a civil society group. So there are lots of ways we can get to that table. And then once we're there, we need a kind of conversation that allows, if we don't come to agreement, at least we agree about some basic facts, we agree about what matters, we find out where we can find some overlap in what we want, we identify differences, and we gain a certain sort of trust and respect for each other, or try and maintain it. And then we have to get up from that table and act on that discussion. And so in each of these three sort of phases of democracy, we can see that there's been challenges posed by the different digital techniques that foreign actors and domestic actors have been using.
Like the hacking and like the trolling and the fake news, that sort of a thing.
Precisely.
Yeah, and just the incivility in general, I would think, is part of it as well. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Forstall, what would you add?
So I think a lot of what Chris has said is right on the money. You know, we know that a lot of what we need to make democracy work is not only the sort of good information, we need to be able to identify the things that we need to talk about at that table. We need to know who those people are with that are talking with us. We need to know how to talk to one another to get back to the civility thing. You know, where I come from, which is a little bit different, is thinking about not only sort of how that table might be changing and who the actors are, but also, right, how the table is designed. And so a lot of what these digital technologies are introducing into the conversation is a whole new way of organizing people and publics. And so it's not just sort of the kind of information that we need to be looking at. We also need to be looking at how that information and why that information is being spread the way that it is, sort of how these technologies are bringing us together in new
or
and
not bringing us together, I think, in many cases.
Exactly, how they are organizing or perhaps disorganizing the public.
Dividing in many ways rather than sharing a table, having disparate tables perhaps.
Right, and in some cases, you know, the thing about digital technologies that is not the case in physical space is that you don't often see the table for what it is, right? So many, like there are 2 billion people on Facebook, but you know, we don't all recognize that we're sitting in the same space. We're sort of in, you know, alternate dimensions where we can all see, you know, we're all there, but like we're in different phases of existence, and so we don't really see each other in the same way.
So let's talk about some of these phenomena that you two have been looking at. Maybe we should start with the hacking, because the hacking is done for multiple reasons. Talk us through some of these reasons.
Right. So There are different ways to use this word hacking, for starters. People in the digital technology world often use it in a positive way. You work on a hack of your system in order to get it to do something better or do something different. And that's worth thinking about. Another way is we use hacking just if it has anything to do with an online technology and there's a problem, we call it hacking. So for me, hacking, I use more specifically, at least in the negative context, is system intrusions, usually to access data that people aren't supposed to. And so the most prominent cases we saw in the recent election were the hacking of the Democratic National Committee's communications and the hacking of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta's, his email and communications. And so on the one hand, so this is a clear legal violation of privacy of data, and that's a bad thing to do in election. But it's not just about, you know, breaking and entering. It's very important is the way those hacks were used. They were very strategically rolled out to maximize attention to them instead of other issues that maybe warranted, you know, greater discussion and action after the election. They were leveraged to sow the greatest distrust possible around some of the people involved, particularly in the, for people of a certain political persuasion. And so it's not just the system intrusion, it's very much that this hacking and getting at people's private data is then used in these ways to undermine, again, the quality of conversation, the ability to talk about other issues.
And the ability to talk across the table at all. And this is hypothesized to have been done by Russians. Do we know this to be true yet?
I think we can be pretty confident, although some of the most conclusive data is not public, or some of the final pieces of the puzzle. So by that I mean there's a lot of things in the way that the system intrusion happened and the way that, so technically that it happened, that indicated these Russia-linked groups. The alignment with an overall policy of Russia around the election, around information warfare is maybe strong, but at least information interference, consistent. And then some of the other key information, which we don't know, but we get assurances from intelligence agencies, is some of that more human intelligence and finding out, yes, we have evidence, more specific evidence about orders given or who actually asked for what. But the thing that's so tricky about these things is that there can be different people in this chain. The person who achieves the exploit of a system isn't necessarily the person doing the leaking. Right? And so is it possible some are not Russian affiliated? I think, you know, that's possible. Moreover, and again, this is how I mentioned before about how it's domestic and foreign actors, and they often are kind of working together. So when Donald Trump, for instance, says, please hack Hillary's emails, calling for Russian hackers to do so, I mean, that's a very obvious and public way, but there are a lot of ways in which there was a willing domestic constituency to take this information when they get it and advance it. And so, yes, I think it's pretty clear there was a significant contribution of Russian or Russian-supported actors, but it's certainly not them by themselves.
Now, in your paper, you suggested this is not altogether new. It's just kind of risen to a new level and in multiple countries.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how pervasive are we talking about?
Information insecurity is absolutely pervasive. We know this from the phenomenal numbers of cybercrime. So data is getting access and use all the time. In fact, most hacks of political groups are probably not leaked because there's huge amounts of state espionage and following each other's conversations that they use in strategic ways but would never leak. The leak of these big parts of documents is fairly new. There's some really good research by a group out of Oxford called the Computational Propaganda Team that has looked at how bots are used in, I think, 10 different countries, from Poland to Taiwan to Canada, where I'm from, to the United States. And so we get a pretty good picture, first of all, that's pervasive because these digital platforms are there to be gamed. They have these vulnerabilities. But it is used in different ways. And we can also see that different countries that are vulnerable in different ways. So I'll just say one little thing about the French election, which is an interesting comparison to the US one. There was a very prominent, again, leak of hacked documents called the Macron leaks, because at that time, presidential candidate Emmanuel Macron was about to begin the, it was the second round of presidential elections when this came out. And it was a strange leak in a way, because it was a huge amount of information. It wasn't actually that much about Macron. There was deliberately introduced falsehoods about Macron in it, so it wasn't revealing necessarily like a big truth. It was doctoring these things and then pretending they were true in order to leverage them. Another thing that's interesting about it is a lot of the bots that were promoting attention to it on Twitter were the same accounts that were being used to promote pro-Trump messaging in the US elections. And they were very ineffective, partly as the timing, and there was a media blackout then right before the French election. Partly, a lot of them were writing apparently in English, and so not necessarily persuasive to a French voter. And partly a different political culture, where parties or groups within France may not have been as keen to jump on illegal activity and use it for electoral advantage.
You know, in your paper here at APSHA, you also mentioned issues like self-determination and sovereignty and how these are now at threat too.
I think they are in a few ways. So most basically, you can't think of the citizens of a country as being self-determining if one of the most important acts, which is to decide their government, is interfered in and no longer seen as legitimate by many of the citizens for that result. We don't really know that the outcome would have been different barring foreign actor involvement in the US one, but it certainly has lowered the trust and legitimacy of that. So that's a clear interference of sovereignty. International law struggles to characterize that and provide opportunities to take action on it at the international level, and that's a problem. That's a difficult thing to deal with. But in addition to that, there's things like if a country wants to structure the conversations that people are having within their country, want to develop laws to regulate it, and then a foreign-owned social media company doesn't enforce hate speech laws at the right time or in alignment with what the country wants, you can say that those people aren't able to really be self-determining, democratic citizenry using the processes they want, that they've decided for themselves, because decisions about how they will talk to each other are being regulated elsewhere or decided elsewhere.
Jennifer Forrestal, let's bring you in now. You've been focusing on the proliferation of fake news and the trolling, and how do you see that as within this conversation of, oh my God, what's happening with democracy?
Sure. So again, I'm sort of going to jump off of a lot of the things that Chris says, because what I think that he's pointing to, particularly with a really interesting comparison between France and the United States, right, is that it's more than just the strategies that people are using, and it's more than just the technologies themselves that are available. It's also sort of this, especially this comparison, sort of forces us to look at the wider social and political sort of culture, I think is the word you used, that, you know, gives us a context within which propaganda, misinformation, disinformation either works or is successful or isn't, right? And again, as I think you opened the segment, this isn't new, right? Harold Laswell wrote in like 1927 with regards to the First World War that, you know, propaganda isn't about being a good PR person. It's about taking advantage of a disorganized public, right? A bunch of citizens that don't understand how they're connected with one another, that don't have those ties of trust and reciprocity, solidarity. And so, you know, when we think about what to do about this, right, like what does democracy mean in a digital age, a lot of that is sort of how do we build sites and spaces that can sort of recapture or support and maintain those kinds of relationships that give sort of grounding to the hard work of democratic politics, right? How can we make sure that people's ties between citizens aren't totally disrupted with you know, bad news, or sort of things that make you sad that, you know, don't get people running off of Facebook, which happened in the wake of the 2016 election, right? Like, how do we keep people at the table? And so these are sort of questions that I think these problems open up that go beyond just like, we need better information out there.
Okay, so what about the paid end of this? So how do you deal with that? For example, the paid trolls. Both of you have sort of mentioned trolling, and many of them are on somebody's payroll, whether it's a foreign country or a local political operative.
So,
and before you even do that, also be thinking, because we talked earlier about, well, what is the effect of trolling? Maybe you should talk about that first.
Sure. So trolling, in my understanding of it, and this is controversial, there's a million different ways that you can define trolling. And a woman named Whitney Phillips does really great work in this area, so everyone should go read her stuff. But the way that I understand trolling from a particularly political perspective is that this is, it's a particular kind of activity that you engage in with the intention of sort of shutting down a conversation. So democracies need people to continue to want to be at the table, right? The whole idea of democracy is that even when you lose, you'll come back to play again and hope to win another day. And trolls aren't interested in that. And so, you know, paid trolling is a little bit different because they don't seem to have that kind of personal investment. But there are a lot of things that we can do and that we've seen be successful in, again, building tighter knit communities online that can sort of insulate themselves from trolls so that when the like wrecking ball of a troll comes through and tries to spread hatred or misinformation or death threats in the worst case scenario for women, mostly women of color, then they can sort of heal and protect themselves and say, like, that's not acceptable in this space. And so, there's a lot of other better research on this that sort of does the actual strategies, but a lot of them are things like moderation, sort of posting the rules and making it clear that, you know, that is not how we comport ourselves in this space. So, you know, again, but all of that goes back to thinking about these as more than just sort of bland, you know, internet tubes that send information without any kind of bias or whatever, right? Like these sites are designed in specific ways. And if citizens are actually going to be sort of the whole democratic citizens taking responsibility for the facets of their lives that affect them, we need to start thinking more seriously about how those sites are constructed and the kinds of communities we want.
Yeah.
Just to add one thing that Jenny presented this week, and that's so smart in her approach to this, is to point out that there are two very broad ways of going about making these spaces better. One is to look at the issues around gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the concern is that conventional journalism and its ethics of professionalism and ability to investigate and disseminate news is being undermined. So we might want to support more of that. We might want to have social media sites doing like a tougher job of regulating what is aggressive or hateful conversation on their sites. We might want them to flag things that are not from where they appear to be. So there's a lot of things that we would ask people to do in the design of the table we're at. Mm-hmm. And then, but Jenny's additional point is, let's not think that's the only answer, because if we do that, then we're surrendering our conversation to these gatekeepers in some way. And so we have to also make sure that citizens themselves are engaging this conversation about how we should be speaking with each other, that I imagine that they're trying out different ways of doing things, and that we're cultivating among citizens some of these, you might call it the ethics or just basic respect or civility, you know, different terms for it, but ways of engaging with fellow citizens so that we don't need to be regulated, that some of it is bubbling up.
Mm. Yeah, so yes, thanks. That's exactly what I'm arguing. But
that's exactly what you said earlier.
Yeah, that's exactly what I presented on Thursday.
He was listening.
But yeah, so and part of that, right, a big part of that is that when we tend to focus on the problem of misinformation, we focus on the facts. And this was a huge part of our conversation on Thursday, right, is truth and not truth and facts and lies. But facts are really only part of the story. As I imagine any good journalist will tell you, presentation of those facts makes a whole big difference, right? And the audience that you're playing to. And again, sort of thinking about how we cultivate those norms of discourse that teach you how to present facts in a compelling way. And, you know, that again means that we can't allow elites to do that for us, right? The gatekeeping is not enough if we want the sort of robust democracy that I think many of us do.
So you're both quite optimistic about the possibilities.
Maybe.
Optimistic is strong. I would say optimistic that there are opportunities. Mm-hmm. It's not the right response to say, now that the internet is here, we are unable to agree on truths and foreign actors will have their way with our elections.
Right.
That's absolutely not true. On the other hand, there's a lot of difficult things that need to be done and innovations that are needed in order to address these issues.
So I wonder too, when you've got all of these simultaneous threats that are coming from technology, really information technology, and then at the head of a country like the United States, you have a guy like Donald Trump who is then adding to it with his own disinformation, mm-hmm. and simultaneously attacks on traditional journalism as fake news. Granted, they're not perfect and they make a lot of mistakes and they're kind of narrow in their perspective, but at least they try to fact check. These are big problems. And yeah. when I speak with, you know, average voters who may have been engaged, they're like, we don't know what to believe. They throw their hands up in the air like, what do we do? What's your response, Jennifer?
Oh, man. I think that's a good question, right? And it's clearly, again, one that we've been grappling with for at least 100 years, right? Like, again, I'm a political theorist. I study the history of political thought. And this is a problem that, like, at least dates back to the early 20th century with the guys I'm reading. It definitely dates back millennia, right? Like, this is just a problem of politics. These sites are here to stay. And so in some cases, I don't know that optimism or pessimism is the way to go. And it's just sort of like, what can we do to use them to make people feel less that way, less hopeless and disorganized? And again, the strategy that I am taking as my small part of that scholarly endeavor is to think about how we can design Facebook better, how we can design Twitter better, right? So I don't think it's a coincidence that disinformation spreads particularly fast on Twitter and spread very quickly on Facebook, not only because they're widely used, but also because of the structure of those sites, right? And, Facebook, I think, realized that after 2016 and is thinking more about their sort of obligation or responsibility to the public. And I think, you know, there's a lot that we then can do as experts in this to help them with that conversation, so...
And I'd just say that there are vicious circles, but also virtuous circles possible in this area. Mm-hmm. So the vicious circle that I've been looking at is there are these vulnerabilities in our politics and how we communicate online and the digital technologies more broadly that foreign actors are taking advantage of and making us more distrustful of each other, of the truths that we put forward and so on. And that then sort of incentivizes domestic actors and parties and politicians to continue to act as badly and take advantage of it. But the virtuous circles are possible as well. So if sites respond to that problem and design themselves a bit better and increase the range of views, considered views that we encounter, then we start having better conversations about how to regulate it. And then with better regulations introduced in campaigning, we are more trusting of our political figures and hold them to a higher standard of behavior than some. We're in a vicious circle now, and getting to that virtuous circle is tricky, but it can build on itself, I hope.
Well, I add to that, because I study traditional media, mm-hmm. that the traditional media norms, which are designed to be attention-getting, are the things that may have led us down this path. You know, soundbite, dramatic, conflict orientation, mm-hmm. and so these have become the eye catchers, mm-hmm. and so it's the economic model that kind of made it that way. And so then when you translate, well, Twitter and Facebook and all of these others are also in the economic model, which is you have to have people paying attention in order to get your stock priced a little bit higher. So with that in mind, is it the model that's broken?
Like the model of capitalism is sort of where we got to. Yeah, it seems like these conversations always go there. So I guess I will start answering that question in much the same pragmatic mode that I answered, I think, the optimism pessimism question, which is like, sure, maybe capitalism is actually the root of all evil. Marx was right. But I think that it might be here to stay. And so, you know, again, I think the more interesting and actually more difficult question is, you know, within these confines, what can we start doing to make it better, much as Marx would hate that answer, right? What band-aids can we put on this problem? Again, like, I think that's where a lot of this work is kind of trying to go, right? It's not, Facebook is here, right? And so again, sure, we can criticize that, and I think we should continue doing that, right? If your bottom line is monetizing our identities and our demographic boxes, like, that's maybe a problem, and we can talk about that. But simultaneously, we also need to be talking about what they can be doing in the interim to make those sites not so terrible.
Yeah, and I just add, people are not just going to turn off their computers one day. They need alternatives that they move to. So a lot of people are very frustrated with what they've got. I think many people would pay rather than having purely ad-driven models for some platforms. They would pay to get journalism, to get opportunities to communicate with fellow citizens that is more fulfilling, that doesn't leverage their anger and other emotions as quickly, that doesn't cheapen the conversation. And so I think we need to make sure there are alternatives out there.
And there are. I mean, going back to traditional media, I've been thinking a lot recently about NPR, right? Like, that, again, is a model that does a lot to, like, build local communities, to make sure to contextualize information that can seem very overwhelming when you're just getting it in a straight information overload on Twitter. But again, it's sort of a smaller kind of very cultivated and sort of long sustained kind of news spreading that is connected but distinct and can, again, tailor information a little bit better to the communities of interest that it knows that it serves, without perhaps doing disservices. And so, you know, maybe it needs to be public funded. That's also something that we haven't talked about at all.
But yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, but I do think, again, there are models
out
there.
You guys have it in Canada.
And I don't know that Facebook is going to go, you know, nonprofit or become the state social media. But again, I think that even when we talk about traditional media versus new media, there are, I think, interesting models that we can use even within that.
Yeah, I think the last thing that we didn't get to that I wanted to is about destroying the trust in the very system. In other words, if people don't trust their democratic government or their democratic processes or their sources of information, is that a way of, say, a foreign entity to then destroy really essentially the fundamentals of a country?
Yes, it is. And it is a strategy that some governments have intentionally employed in the past. It's a great way to weaken an opponent, to achieve what you want because they're distracted and turning against each other. And this is both historical, we could come up with many examples, and it's the way many people describe the information operations of Russia, but it's not only Russia that tries to take advantage of conflicts within different citizenry in other countries in order to get what they want.
Well, thank you both so very much. Chris Tenove and Jennifer Forrestal, it's been a great pleasure to host you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Forrestal is a professor of political science at Stockton University. Chris Tenove, he's a postdoctoral research fellow at the Center for Ethics and the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto.